Well, welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record. I think I've talked quite a bit this year about the streak we've been on of a lot of guests that were first-time guests to Capitol Record this year. But we're ready to start having some repeat guests if they qualify as, you know, Hall of Famers. And that's what Renee is joining us here today. We had Renee on late last spring, early summer, talking national security, talking macro economics, foreign policy, a lot of the things in his wheelhouse. But we're bringing Renee back today because we want to be really specific about an issue that I think has become one of the leading experts and research-oriented minds on in the country, and that is, of course, the specifics in national security and geopolitics with Russia, Ukraine, but also some of the economic and financial markets ramifications of that. So allow me to bring on my very dear friend, my brother, and one of the true intellectual giants of macro intelligence, Renee Ananow of Corbu. Renee, welcome back to Capitol Record.
David, you're too kind, brother. I love you. Thank you very much, though. It's so great to be here. One-year anniversary, man.
One-year anniversary, and of course, listeners know that a few weeks ago, we had your colleague Samuel Rhines on talking energy. We had had him on earlier, but that was way back when oil was at $80. So when it hit 120, we had to kind of revisit this stuff, you know? If we see 150 on WTI, I'm going to need Sam to come back on, okay?
He's the best at translating a lot of the complex geopolitical and policy insights into actionable ideas for market participants. So it's great to have him as well. But yes. I don't do media, as you know. I mean, our colleagues do, but the only person I trust in this environment to do media with is you, brother. So it's great to be here.
I appreciate that. I think I think you mean that as a compliment to me and your willingness to kind of have these conversations with me with a camera running or a microphone being recorded. But, you know, I also think the Capitol Record listeners are kind of up our alley in the sense of a strong group of people who already have presuppositions about capital markets, about free enterprise, a strong care for the Protestant work ethic, for a certain vision of social thought. And right now we're dealing with a geopolitical disruption that you have been writing about a lot before, particularly for some of your hedge fund clients, prior to Putin's invasion. And then obviously writing and deep in the weeds on many things. I'll get a little caveat out of the way for listeners. There may be some things that I ask that you can't answer, that and there are certain things I won't ask because I know you can't. But, you know, you're deep into sources on some of this. And I want to separate that from op-ed. There's people that will express opinions. You know, Biden should provide Ukraine this, and Putin should be given an off-ramp here, or Zelensky's right about this or wrong about that. I think that in a country that values free thought, all of that's okay. People have different opinions. But it strikes me a lot of what you're doing, Renee, is not opinion in an editorializing way, but it's source-driven
analysis.
Why is that important for one to understand the difference in financial markets and in terms of what's going on? Is the media not a reliable source for the rest of us?
You know, it's a super interesting point because when I really started my career as an analyst, it was really because I needed to get it straight from the horse's mouth. Because the things that you read on the headlines, I mean, this started during the Trump era, right? Is that the headlines that you read of what the president said actually were not what the president said at all, right? Mm. And, you know, I had a very kind of well-known analyst who was, you know, on the other side of the aisle and said, oh, actually, he's a great geopolitical and macro analyst, that household name, and said, oh, well, I don't follow Trump's tweets. And I don't know how you can do your job setting aside, right, whether you agree with the policy or not, in terms of not understanding what White House policy is, right? And that also includes our adversaries, U.S. adversaries, right? So I think, as you know, I mean, we have very rigorous dialogues with folks in China, with folks in the Middle East, even with folks in Russia up until February the 24th, which now, because of Putin's unfortunately draconian laws, we can't put people into a security risk, right? But it's important to understand what the other side is thinking, right? It's important for conservatives to understand Marxist thought. It's important for progressives to understand Calvin and Luther, right? So I think this is just an intellectual framework that we always try to have here at Corbu, is to get down to ground truth, right?
Well, tell me this. When you look at the notion of having open inquiry about other points of view, other perspectives, certainly one who wants to be an intelligent critic of Marx has to study Marx. It's a real intellectual cowardice that wants to hold off from studying original sources. But when it comes to dissecting the news, yes, people can read Trump's tweets to become better Trump critics. Yes, one can read, you know, the original point of view. But I'm even referring to foreign policy about getting information that may not be readily accessible. In your line of work now as an analyst that is kind of juxtaposing macroeconomics with policy intelligence, it isn't even just different points of view. It's different sets of data, different access to information. Do you think that there's a lot of information flow about Ukraine that the pop media does not have and is not providing, that people like yourself do have, that change opinions, change perspective a little bit?
Absolutely do. And that's, you know, I think the second core pillar of what we do is that ultimately we take the sources or the intelligence and then ultimately develop our own analysis of the situation and what the implications are for not just policymakers, but most importantly for market participants, right? And to your point about not being the right narrative in popular media about Ukraine, right? And about the invasion, it's totally correct, because the conflict there has absolutely almost nothing to do with what the popular media claims that it's about. I will tell you this, the invasion in Ukraine has nothing to do with democracy. It has nothing to do with human rights, right? It has to do with what type of world that we want to live in for the rest of the 21st century, and about whether the United States and the West is going to uphold what's called the rules-based order, which we'll get to in a second, because that is so important and so core and so key and so taken for granted that we don't even realize the tremendous gravity and importance that the rules-based order is and what's at stake, right? So look, I came here a year ago, and we talked about that national security was going to dominate economic and market concerns. And my long-held theme since 2019, which is that the re-regionalization of the world, right? And that we were going to splinter into a world of competing blocks, right? So we sit here April 13th, 2022, and surely that's officially the case, right?
And when you said it a year ago and re-regionalization was such a huge theme of what you were talking about a year ago, did you imagine it would look like the re-regionalization we're seeing now?
I didn't think that the catalyst would come from Putin, right?
Well,
we thought it would always be with China.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And this is what's so interesting about it, is that now we clearly have a world of blocks. And there's two blocks. There's a block governed by rules, and there's a block governed by force. Mm-hmm. And that's the world that we're living in. Now, these blocks are not, you know, we call it, and I even call it East versus West, right? It's really not East versus West geographically, because they're gerrymandered blocks, right? I mean, in the East, you have Japan and Korea, and Australia, right? In the West over here in Western Hem, you know, you have Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua and also the Latin American countries, right? But it comes down to an ideological idea about the relationship of the individual versus the state, ultimately, right? And, you know, we secularize it as philosophy or ideological competition, right? But you and I have had these great conversations, and I hope we'll have it again, that this is ultimately a theological debate.
Yeah.
It really is. The rules-based order is a theological debate. And, you know, we talk about that, oh, well, the Cold War never finished. And the president said that in Warsaw, Poland, a couple of weeks ago, right? But I take less, I think, takeaways from the Cold War. And really, this is really about more like the 30 Years' War, from 1618 to 1648. And we claim that those were religious wars, but they really weren't. They were really about these blocks and about whether you were going to live in a block governed by the rules or a block governed by force, right? So I think that's clearly where we're at. And this is why this is so important.
What do you say, Renee, to those who suggest that a block governed by rules is still ultimately a block governed by force because force is needed to enforce the rules?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the case, right? That we live in a material world and we're material beings, right? And we're subject to the forces of gravity and all of those things, right? But the question is, what is the organizing principle? What is the chief cornerstone around which the society and the economy is built, right? Mm-hmm. And the rules-based order governed by rules, I'll go there, is that this was ultimately a Calvinist concept, right? Now, let me delve into this for just 2 minutes, right? When you think about what the three big, I think, contributions of Calvinist thought were, was that number one, you had something called the universal priesthood, which was that everyone could become a priest if they wanted to, right? And that everyone had equal value before the eyes of God, or now we've secularized it to the law. That's number one. Second big principle was that the word or the scripture, or now secularized as the law, was the determining principle for justification. Or back then we called it salvation, right? But now it is that what do we appeal to, right? In terms of order and in terms of to make the moral decisions in the society is that we go to the law or to the rules, the word written down, right? And that ultimately then that flowed into the third principle was that each individual then had a choice, right? To congregate or assemble with other like-minded individuals who believe the same way. Now, those are the three principles, and maybe you think this is a 17th century idea or 16th century discussion. But when you think about what the three principles of the rules-based order are, and this comes from the White House, number one, the principle of sovereignty. Number two, the principle of territorial integrity. And number three, the principle of self-determination. And what are those things? Sovereignty, that big countries don't matter more than small countries, and that small countries matter just as much as big countries. Sovereignty, number one. Territorial integrity, number two, right? That then you had a certain set of rules, and those rules governed, right, your borders. And look, this goes back to the Bill of Rights. I mean, when you look at the 10 Bill of Rights in the United States, I mean, most of them have to do with the state interfering on your body, right? Territorial integrity. The third principle of self-determination is that nation states, right, have a choice to determine who they want to ally themselves with, right? And ultimately, this is about that, you know, force is not more powerful than the word, right? That authoritarian dictatorships are not more powerful than representative government, right? And that this is what we are fighting for. This is what the battle of this is about. That Putin invoked, right, was that ultimately this is about democracy. This is about the rule of law. This is about representative government. And that if we're not willing to defend that, right, because this is what is being challenged. It started with 9/11, right? Putin believes this. Xi Jinping believes this. And I will tell you during our dialogues with, you know, different U.S. adversaries is that they know these principles better than we do.
Yeah.
They articulate all of these different things, right? So this is for all the marbles.
So your view would be not in talking about what ought to be, but in talking about what is, that actor on the world stage like Putin knows full well the distinction between rule by rules and rule by force, and that the battle is that he is asking for a world ruled by force contra the concept of an international rules-based order.
Correct.
And so there is a philosophical divide between those two notions of social organization, and Putin prevailing in this conflict goes beyond the land dispute, so to speak. I have air quotes going to say that. It goes beyond a land dispute in Ukraine, but fundamentally is attached to the very concept of the rules-based order, which I believe you would argue, and I know I would, has profound implications for financial markets.
Absolutely.
I mean, financial markets are the textbook of a rules-based order, aren't
that's
they?
That's right. It's beautiful, right? Oh. I mean, if you talk to Russians privately, and if you talk to even many Chinese people privately, they will tell you that only large countries have sovereignty, right? And, you know, the Chinese even said it one day out loud at an APEC meeting when they told, I think it was Papua New Guinea, right? China's a big country and you're a small country, so that's just how it is.
Yeah.
Right? And I got to tell you, that is, this rules-based order is a total exception in world history. Because since time immemorial until 1945, right, it has always been a block by force. That's how it worked. Essentially. Now, it may have been competing blocks, and there may have been rules within certain specific nation states, right? But that was de facto in practice how the world worked, right?
So you don't think the rules-based order crystallized until after the Allies successfully won World War II, and the formation of groups like NATO are what crystallized the rules-based order?
I totally agree.
Or do you think that the philosophy existed back to the Monroe Doctrine?
I think the philosophy existed starting in 1517. You know when that date was, right? Since the Reformation, when some little guy from the other side of civilization said, actually told the Pope, we're not going to do that anymore, right? Mm. But it wasn't made manifest until 1945 when America actually had its first turn on the world stage. It's only been 77 years, right? And I will tell you that it happened right after Hiroshima. That great use, probably the greatest use of force in human history, right? After that was deployed, we said, okay, we're not going to do that, though. We're not going to go back and have nuclear coercion on everyone, right? We're going to institute instead this rules-based order, you know? And I will tell you, let me kind of segue to a small little personal story that I think you'll enjoy, because I always tell people this when I try to explain what the rules-based order is. So I grew up in a very, very strict Calvinist environment. And I got to tell you, David, I always say it was the most beautiful formalism of all time. Because here was the situation, was that there was a set of rules. And that these rules, even if you did not like them, were put into place by people who loved you. And that it was in your self-interest to follow them, right? And here was the rub, was that there were these rules. If you followed them, you would be handsomely rewarded. But if you didn't follow them and you chose not to, then you would bear the consequences of those decisions. But there were always two implications. Number one was that you always had a choice. And number two, whatever happened, the outcome, you always deserved it because you had that choice, right? And so this is where we're confronted today. When you look at the, you know, my wife has this great saying. She says that she's an artist and she says people get the governments they deserve. And the punchline is, and spouses too, right? And look, when you look at the polls in Russia, right? Over 80% of the population above the age of 25 agrees with the invasion of Ukraine. And over 70%
is that reliable data? Is that reliable?
I think that it is, right? It's from Levada. Okay, so you can take what it is. Maybe it's propaganda, maybe it's not, right? But do you think that Putin would go out there and do what he's doing without knowing that he had popular support for it?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't buy it, right? So this is the rub of the issue, is that when you look at the last 77 years, there has been no greater increase in wealth in human history than since 1945. And ironically, from the very people and the very nation states that now want to destroy it. So this goes back to the rules when I was a kid, right? They are there because someone put them there because they love you as a human being, right? And it is regardless, it's in your self-interest to do it,
mm-hmm.
right? So look, I mean, I think that's unfortunately where we're at. And this is going to have profound implications, both for policymakers, for market participants, and for our way of living, right? Until this is settled. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about Ukraine and Russia now. We can kind of segue.
Yeah, I do. Let's maybe move past a bit of the kind of, you know, philosophical framework around a lot of this, and just from a tactical standpoint. First, let me ask a series of questions. Were you surprised Russia invaded? That's question number one.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think you saw
saw
a lot of my notes ahead of time, right?
Yeah.
So let me kind of go into this, because I totally got this wrong. Because up until February 23rd, I thought that this was an exercise in coercive diplomacy. Now, I will tell you, folks in Russia that we talked to, up until February 23rd, thought that this was coercive diplomacy,
yeah.
right? And, you know, there's a guy over at the American Enterprise Institute, Fred Kagan, who all of you should follow, knows more about Russian urban warfare than anyone alive, right?
Yeah.
And on the flip side of it, he also thought that Putin was not going to do this, him from a military standpoint, because he looked at how the troops were arrayed and said, well, clearly, this is going to be a really bad war, so he's not going to do it. My logic was, well, Putin clearly doesn't want to do this because he's going to make himself an international pariah. He's going to invoke a whole slew of sanctions. He's going to degrade the structural capacity of his economy, and it'll be the end of the Putin regime and maybe even the end of the Russian state. Why would you do that, right? So my best example, and sure enough, he did it anyway, right? So the best example of this that I kind of always use is Saddam Hussein and George W. Bush, right? So there's this great story that after Saddam Hussein was captured in the hole, right, the FBI brought him up, cleaned him up and everything. And first question that they asked him was, so Saddam, how did you get here? And you know what his response was? I didn't believe Bush. And when President Bush heard that, he was very offended. And he said, how could he not believe me, right? I told him you have 48 hours to leave, right? How could you question my credibility? Which is what Putin was doing to Biden, right? And I got to tell you, I always say, in some sense, Saddam was the more quote-unquote rational actor in a way, right? Because his belief after that was, look, we really don't have these weapons of mass destruction. And in any case, if you do this, it's going to cost you trillions and trillions of dollars. You're going to get bogged down in the region. You're going to lose international credibility. All the things that actually happened, right, materialized. But what mattered ultimately was that the president of the United States said something. And when he said something, as President Biden says, big nations don't bluff. And that was a precedent that he had to set, right? So I was very surprised, because I did not think that Putin, you knew he didn't really want to be part of the West or the rules-based order, but you also didn't realize, at least I didn't realize, that he also wanted to take the whole house down with the rest of the invasion as well, right? So, you know, there's this great book that was published in 1911. It's by a guy named Norman Engel. It's called The Great Illusion. And it was predicated that the Great Illusion was war again in Europe. And it was based on the belief that countries that trade with one another do not go to war with one another. Published in 1911 and 1912, right? it's a certain type of Marxist materialism, right? And so, look, I mean, clearly the rest is history. And I think, you know, what ultimately has happened tactically from the Russian side is that since 2017, they knew that time's up, that they needed to accelerate the confrontation with the West forward. Because if you waited, it would be too late. Similar to how Japan in 1941, right? They knew they couldn't wait any longer because the best chance that they had after the oil embargo that FDR put on them in 1940 was to try to take out the entire Western Pacific Fleet. They had to do it.
Renee, when you use the analogy of Japan, but Saddam regarding Bush Jr., who did Putin not take seriously? Was it NATO? Was it Germany? Was it Beijing that he thought they would be even more of an enabler to his agenda than they have been? Was it Biden and U.S. or was it Ukraine? What did Putin misunderstand here?
I think he missed all of those things.
First
and foremost, with Ukraine, right? So from our understanding, Putin does not pay attention to any military generals, Gerasimov and all the guys in the Western Southern District. He doesn't trust military generals, kind of like Stalin, by the way, right? He trusts his longtime political advisors. Shoigu, who's basically the version of Secretary Austin, is not a military guy. He was, he founded the United Russia Party in 1991, right? Petrushev, Narushkin, guys like that, right? That were telling him things, probably, because they're all involved in the corruption game together, right? That he could do this in a matter of days. And that was kind of like his version of 15 days to slow the spread, right? That's the first thing. But I think what was more important was that he underestimated the degree that Europe still had 1945 in their collective psyche, right? And that knew him. But I think ultimately the most important, and this is the most important to the Russians, is that he totally misread the president and the resolve of the United States, right? And I say took the wrong lessons from January 6th and the Afghanistan withdrawal, right? That was actually contrary to much popular belief. Those were an exercise in anti-fragility of the United States. And
but
we passed
those. You do believe that there was relevance to Putin's movement into Ukraine from the fumbled withdrawal from Afghanistan. Even if you think Putin got it wrong, you think there was a sense of emboldenment by the fumbled exit from Afghanistan.
You know, I think that he took...
that's a consensus view, and I'm not used to you having consensus views.
Well, here's the thing is I think that he didn't look at it closely enough, right? He actually bought into the propaganda. So I always say this, look, there was no greater projection of precision power than that evacuation by the United States military. This is what you have to look at. 7,000 miles away, evacuated 124,000 people, most of them, not Americans, right? Across 6 continents, 26 allies, right? In a matter of under 3 weeks, in a country where there was no infrastructure and where we suffered casualties, and a few minutes later, we continued with the mission. And ultimately, when we got those folks home, the president gets up on stage and says, we are going to welcome them to their new home in the United States of America. There is no country that has the international legitimacy or the logistics capability or the precision power to be able to do that type of humanitarian mission. So imagine when we're going out there to destroy shit, right? He actually bought in misguidedly into the propaganda that the West is in decline and the East is rising.
But even apart from misinterpreting the West, NATO, U.S., he also had to have underestimated Kiev. He had to have underestimated the Ukrainian people, their resources, their numbers. And maybe part of that is overlapped with underestimating NATO, because obviously a lot of Ukraine's fortitude has come from armory provided by NATO. But still, I don't know of anyone who predicted that Ukraine would hold Kiev. And I certainly don't believe that Putin predicted that Ukraine would hold Kiev.
Well, I'll tell you.
Is this the greatest foreign policy misunderestimation since Saddam?
Yeah, it's like the George W. Bush, they misunderestimated me,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, look, this is something that's very important, because the way that Putin underestimated the Ukrainians is that there's a belief out there that Putin wants to reinstate the Soviet Union. And actually, that's totally incorrect. And it's totally incorrect because all you have to do is read what he actually says. And he's very critical of the Bolsheviks, and he's very critical of Stalin, and very critical of the Soviet Union. What he wants to reconstitute is Russians and Russian speakers. And so there's a saying that Putin uses, that wherever Russian is spoken, Russia is. So it comes from a very racist place, ultimately, right? And so obviously racism has a certain type of condescension in it always, right? And that is what led him on his great miscalculation in Ukraine, right? So let's get to kind of where we're at now on the ground there, right? And what the strategies are, and then maybe we can talk about a little bit about nuclear coercion, because this is extremely important, because this is where it's going to go, right? The United States and what I call the NATO plus allies are pursuing a de facto regime change strategy versus Putin. They're not going to come out and say it that way, but when you look at the slate of sanctions that are not only in place, but that are coming down the pike, this is very important to remember. When sanctions are about deterrence, i.e. changing behavior, the conditions for relief must be made explicit to the target. There have been no conditions for relief made to Putin, because clearly the sanctions will only come off when Putin is gone. Full stop, number one, right? So this is now a compellent strategy to induce punishment. And part of that inducing the punishment is also to send a deterrent signal to other big countries, you know who they are. That's number one, right? But number two, we are engaging in a what I call mutual war of attrition, right? Because the point of the Western sanctions are to, over time, degrade the capabilities of the Russian Federation military so that Putin suffers an ignominious defeat in Ukraine or elsewhere, right? Which, you know, similar to 1979, which led to the fall of the Soviet Union. Now, on the flip side, there is also another war of attrition going on, because Putin and all of his cronies and other leaders of other nation states believe this fact more than anything, that the West is a decadent society and that they cannot withstand any pain, any significant pain. So when you look at what is going on the ground there, where critical infrastructure is being totally destroyed, there is no effort to occupy the land, right? Because even in Nazi France, right, the theater still ran. Well, that's not the case today in Ukraine, right? And the point of that is to create shortages of critical goods, raw materials, agriculture, etc., that it inflicts pain, inflationary pain, on the West, right? And here is the strategy near term. It is clearly the Battle of Kyiv was lost. So now there's this regrouping into the East to try to landlock Ukraine, right?
Let's time out real quick.
Yep.
The Battle of Kyiv was lost in the first 5 days after invasion, mm-hmm, by the fact that it wasn't won. It's now gone on for 6 weeks. And at this point, when you say lost, is that simply because they've been unable thus far to occupy, or have they given up? What's the situation on the ground? Are they gone from Kyiv?
I don't believe that they've given up for one second. Because the objective of the quote-unquote special military operation, number one, was, quote, denazification. And in Russian code language, that means the decapitation of the government in Ukraine and replacing it with another government that is sympathetic to the Russian state, right? So this is just a tactical retreat, number one, right? But the point is then to, I think this is how this is going to play out, is that if there can be territorial gains in the East, right, where you can cut off the Ukraine from the sea and from the ports and gain additional territories close to the Donbas, which was supposedly the initial catalyst for this invasion, right? Is that then at that point, Putin can come to the negotiating table with leverage because he has territorial gains and maybe can sell that back at home, right? And then say, okay, now I'm ready to deal. And if you want to avoid further humanitarian atrocities and crises, right, then give me what I want. And he's betting, under the threat of further violence, right, that the United States will, and NATO, and certain European countries, and the rest of the globe will say, okay, enough. We want peace, right? That is what I am concerned about. And I got to tell you, I do not believe at this point, anytime soon, that NATO, and in particular the President of the United States, is going to accept those terms, right? And that's why you see $1 billion a day of security assistance coming from the White House, which, by the way, when you add that up, that is not too far from overseas contingency operation levels, right, of the second Gulf War, right? So then the threat of that becomes that, well, if Putin, if we don't capitulate to Putin, then what does he do after that? Probably tries to come back to Kyiv, but with a new threat, which is to use tactical nuclear weapons, right? And that is, I think, the whole thing underlying all of this strategy is that, you know, as some of our Russian friends told us, Putin worships the nukes, and he thinks that he can engage in nuclear coercion. So we're going to have to confront that, and I think that's the big scary part of it, but I would caution both market participants and policymakers to totally dismiss those threats. And we can talk about that if you want.
So, Renee, we're in a situation then where there has been surprises, underestimations, and yet now there is significant confusion about an off-ramp. Now, perhaps the confusion is, why are we even talking about an off-ramp? There won't be an off-ramp. Escalation is inevitable. I know you've had opinions on how foreign policy leadership in our country doesn't have the luxury of ignoring nuclear talk as bluster, that they have to look at contingency planning and so forth. But I guess as much as possible, without the outlier scenarios, within the realm of, let's say, on a bell-shaped curve, just going out one standard deviation good and one standard deviation bad, within that kind of bandwidth of scenario planning, how does this end where World War III is avoided, but there's no internal coup that takes out Putin? And, you know, I know you've been critical of a lot of these theories that do sort of sound a lot more like wishful thinking or a Hollywood movie than a real reality on the ground. Is there some evil genius lieutenant in the KGB that's about to cap Putin, or are we all crazy? Where is this thing going for those of us looking to an end state?
I mean, look, here's the first thing, is this idea that there is a coup coming anytime soon amongst the inner circle, maybe further on down the road, where there is a choice between dying for Putin or giving him up. But they're not there yet, anywhere close, right? So that's a pie in the sky story, right? I think the more likely outcome, if you want to talk about avoiding a confrontation with NATO plus, right, is that this is a protracted, elongated conflict where actually NATO in all but name, right, is fighting this conflict in Ukraine, which, by the way, tactically, from one of our military strategists, tell us is that it's actually easier to defend NATO in Ukraine than it is to defend NATO in NATO, for example, in the Baltics or in Romania or Poland or something like that, right? And that this goes on for so long until ultimately, to put it this way, Putin runs out of bullets and he runs out of support. And then he has to leave because he has no other option, right? But that can go on for a while. Now, that said, from our understanding, Putin in the last 6 weeks has lost over 40,000 troops. The whole force is 200,000. He's lost 40,000 troops.
Lost 40,000 to people abandoning their post or to death?
Death and casualties, right? But to render them unoperational, right?
So not all of them are dead, but they are out of the battlefield.
Out of the battlefield. And that's more in 6 weeks than they lost in Afghanistan in 10 years, mm-hmm. multiple times, right? So if he continues on this run rate, and I think that is why you are seeing the president continue to escalate, right? And provide further weaponry, now not Soviet era stuff, but modern NATO stuff, is that is the end game, right? Is that he runs out of bullets. Now, that presupposes also that he does not have the aid of one other large nation state to resupply him, right? Either with capital or with funds or with lethal weapons, etc. That's to be determined. Maybe that's a segue to the next part of the conversation on the China front. But this is where we're headed, right? That this is not going to end anytime soon, I don't think. It is going to become a frozen, hot conflict. I know that's a little oxymoronic, right? But as the markets go, I think the markets are going to price it as a frozen conflict, right? But that has massive macro impacts on Europe and exchange rates, et cetera, which we can talk about later. But this is a regime change strategy that Putin has to go home in to suffer defeat. So as Margaret Thatcher said, right, that he's not only defeated, but that he's seen to be defeated, so that the privations that the people in the Russian state have had to experience, they identify with him, with Putin, right? And that is the point. So the question is Putin going to let it get there, or is he going to continue to escalate where he wants to bump up against NATO because he does not think that NATO is going to engage in a conflict with him? I don't know. Let's see, right? My own gut, if you want to ask me about it, like after two or three whiskeys, David, is that I do think that he does want to bump up against NATO. I do think that.
And so tell me what you mean by nuclear deterrence policy and how some of that is being altered in the current framework.
Sure. So a lot of the reason I think that we have been so measured, right, and this is not a critique of the administration, it's just the reality of the situation, is that there is a deep concern that if we escalate to a certain point, that Putin is going to nuke us. Plain and simple, right? I don't buy that for a number of reasons. Number one, those nuclear weapons have always been there from Putin's side, right? Number two is that we have an arsenal, the greatest arsenal of nuclear weapons in the history of humanity, made and intended to deter exactly those types of coercive threats, right? Now, it is in the Russian doctrine, and I did not know this until about a month and a half ago, it is in the Russian doctrine to use something called a tactical nuclear weapon, right? In order to what they call escalate to de-escalate, which is that they would use this weapon, that the West would get scared, and that would cause them to then try to capitulate, right? And then obviously to have an outcome that would be beneficial to the Russian state. Now, personally, I do not believe, and there are many people in the Pentagon that agree with me, that there is any such thing as a tactical nuclear weapon. They are all strategic nuclear weapons, right? And being that they are all strategic nuclear weapons, that means that we do not get into these nuclear exchanges, whereas in one of my discussions with one of the Russians was that, oh, well, you know, the West has more to lose because, you know, you'll trade Vladivostok for Austin, and then, you know, after Atlanta for Minsk, and then at some point you'll say, oh, enough is enough, and we can take more pain than you, right? Because you have more to lose. So guys, that's not how it works. If you use a nuclear weapon, the second strike is the end of the Russian state. And that's actually in U.S. nuclear doctrine today. Just read it. Now, the question is, what would the U.S. response be if, for example, Putin uses a tactical nuke? Let's say it doesn't even kill anyone, but he just does it in a field somewhere in Ukraine that's, you know, maybe not very large, but just demonstrates his capabilities.
Is that possible that there is a nuclear that could be struck in Ukraine without hitting anyone? Does the landmass of Ukraine allow for a sort of Kim Jong-un version of a nuclear fire?
I am not a kinetic expert, so I don't know the answer to that with any good certainty. I do know this, however, right, that there's an idea out there about horizontal escalation as a response, which is that we would respond to this tactical nuclear strike with other conventional forces, like, for example, destroying all of Putin's military in a matter of weeks. Now, I got to tell you, that may work, but if we do that, that is the 2022 version of peace for our time, right? Because it has set a precedent then to other countries that actually you can use nuclear weapons and you will not suffer the end of your nation state, right? So especially whenever the nation state was not at existential risk, clearly, right?
Rene, do you think it's wrong of Americans, Westerners, investors to be somewhat tuned out right now in the sense that, of course, this would be profoundly interesting, also in maybe the most understated point of the year, profoundly dangerous, but that the tail risk of a real nuclear event is so minimal and so helpless that it just doesn't register as something in the realm of reality for most people.
I think that is what is going on today. I think, you know, in one of my notes on February 24th, I mentioned this part about nuclear confrontation. And I got a lot of hate mail for that, right? But I'll tell you then, a couple of days later, Putin threatened nuclear coercion against the United States, right? And he hasn't. So this is something that we haven't had to think about for 30 or 40 years because we thought that that was over. But it is now within the realm. And if we are talking about the use of tactical nukes with a horizontal escalatory response, then that actually doesn't mean the end of human civilization, right? Markets can still get through that. So this is something that needs to be priced and at least needs to be paid attention to. And in the very least, we need to understand what the doctrine is from either side, so we don't get spooked, right, if we see a real nuclear threat from a certain side, right? And then understand what it is that the policy response is going to be. Because like I always tell you, David, it's one of my favorite lines is that it's never the exogenous event that's the shock. It's the policy response that's the shock.
Well, and that has a lot of meaning in day-to-day financial realities, in Fed policy, in business cycle events. And yet when you're talking about nuclear conflict, it kind of has a whole different meaning. Rene, do you agree with me that there are some, I'm putting my investor hat on, and we'll bring some of where we're headed now and some of these things back into the lane of applying it to financial markets. Do you agree that there are some events that are non-hedgeable?
It's a great question.
How do you price nuclear war into the left tail?
I think they don't price it. Yeah. Right? So as markets go, kind of doesn't matter. But as policymakers and as citizens, right, then it matters a great deal, right?
You know who's been real hawkish throughout this whole thing is our old friend Bill Ackman. Mm-hmm. And Bill Ackman, understandably, does have a reputation for being a self-promoter. And maybe agendized in some of the things that he has touted, but he's been really bullish on Ukraine and promoted through Twitter a very vigilant and hawkish view of how the West should be supporting Ukraine. And I read some of the responses that people gave to him with this real cynical, skeptical saying of what kind of nuclear war hedge have you put on? You know, you're trying to bait us into war, and what is the package of derivatives you've assembled to bet on this big escalated nuclear conflict? And not only, of course, do I generally find people saying stuff like that to be some of the dumber people in finance, but I was actually thinking literally about the ingredients of what a nuclear war options package looks like. And I'm not particularly sure what ingredients one could compose a nuclear swap basket for that has a counterparty.
Look, here is the kind of controversial thing that I'll say is I think that the threat of nuclear war is a buy, right? Because I don't think that he's going to do it. I don't think that he's going to do it.
Yeah.
Right. So if you see a fade off of that, I think that's a buying opportunity. Now, I mean, if you want to get into these scenarios about nuclear exchanges, then we need to have a policy discussion first about what the doctrine is, right? But as the doctrine now stands, right, there's not going to be a nuclear exchange about Atlanta for Vladivostok and Austin for Minsk and et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't work that way, right? It will be over very, very, very quickly. I can assure you that.
Okay, so we're out of the left tail and we're back into the belly of the beast. Is China going to come out of this a better player on the world stage, a worse player, or the same pretty COVID-impaired player that they were pre-February 24th? And is there another angle in financial markets more important than that? In other words, I don't trade ruble, and I do believe that our U.S. energy exposure is less exposed to the reality of Russian exports than people think. I think we're far more influenced by the stuff Sam and I talked about a few weeks ago, ESG, our own capital markets, this focus on capital discipline. I think there's a lot of supply-demand realities that affect the investable part of U.S. energy more than Putin. So at the end of the day, when it comes to financial markets, what is a more significant anecdotal story to Russia, Ukraine than China?
There isn't. This is what this is ultimately about, because the rules-based order is about the Beijing consensus, right? And what I call the BRICS plus block, right? So let me just give you a couple of things in terms of the view on China and Beijing, right? So there's a guy named at the White House National Security Council. His name is Kurt Campbell, and he's one of the great Asia scholars of our time. And I will argue probably—
I think you should tell our listeners, because we do a lot of Fed talk on this podcast, as you know, who he's married to.
That's also Lyle Brainard's husband, right? So—
Tell me that's not fascinating, that one of the foremost national security names is married to the person who was a whisker away from becoming Fed chair and will become Fed vice chair and probably will become Treasury secretary.
That's right. So if there's, you should always pay attention to what Kurt Campbell has to say. You should read the book, The Pivot to Asia. And next to probably Eric Schmidt, I think the most powerful person in the United States government, right? He said three things about his former beliefs about China was that number one, the Chinese were always rational. Number two, they rarely made mistakes. And number three, if they did, they always course corrected and never doubled down. He doesn't believe those things anymore, because he's been totally disabused of that notion by the evidence of the last 5 years, right? So let me just say one thing. Out of principle, the government in Beijing cannot support the U.S. and NATO response to Putin, because out of principle, they cannot support a regime change strategy. Hopefully that's clear, but it's worth saying that, right? But I think the dirty little secret is that, you know, all this talk about decoupling, it's not the United States decoupling from China. It is the Chinese decoupling from the West, right? They believe that the United States is a lost cause post-Trump. And now with Europe, and you saw this during the summit last week or a couple of weeks ago, right? is that the Europeans to them are in the same boat as the United States on matters of trade, national security, human rights, values, etc. Right? So they are creating an alternative bloc of other countries. They like to say in the global south, right? But it's Russia, it's India, it's South Africa, it's the GCC countries, it's the wealthy Arab world, it's ASEAN, it's Africa, and it's Latin America, right? That is what they believe is the international consensus. Now, I think that is, again, a grave mistake, because there's no country that has been a bigger beneficiary since 1979 of the rules-based order than China. And that includes the United States. That includes the United States, right? So, unfortunately, this is where this is headed.
But maybe in one or two sentences, unpack why, how has China been the biggest beneficiary of the rules-based order? Just in sense of how it coupled with their own democratic capitalism or non-democratic capitalism, how has the rules-based order impacted China so favorably? WTO was more palatable to Western countries because of rules-based order?
Well, because very simply, it implicitly forced a number of structural reforms, liberal structural reforms to the system that resulted in the greatest wealth creation in the shortest period of time in the history of humanity. I don't know, 500 million people taken out of poverty. And if for some reason, as if the United States was a passive actor in that. No, we were the, to use a Marxist term, primary agent, right? In that, because it was in our self-interest and we love the Chinese as a human being, right? So unfortunately, the leadership there has made the decision that to try to revise history and claim that it's not in their interest and that they need to create now an alternative system. So this decoupling or this re-regionalization is where this is headed, and it is not from coming from Trumpism or even Biden's Make It in America Again, which is him, by the way, out-Trumping Trump. And the Make It in America Again Act, by the way, violates almost every chapter of the WTO. On a side note, right? Same as Made in China 2025 violates every chapter of the WTO. So this is where we're at. And I will tell you that the whole pivot to Asia after February 24th ended, because it is clear that we can no longer have a single domain focus, and that now we have to be able to maintain two front wars simultaneously in two theaters, right? And implicitly, and I'll tell you this, David, is that that whole pivot to Asia, and this is not just Kurt Campbell, this is also our side, on the conservative side, Elbridge Colby, same thing. He wrote the 2018 National Defense Strategy. He was all about the pivot to Asia. This is an establishment version of isolationism. It's a more polished version of Rand Paul, that we're gonna basically say F you to our European partners. And we're just going to focus on China, right? We can't do it. That's not the place of the United States as a global superpower, right? We have greater responsibilities than that. So in the meantime, though, this is where Beijing is headed. And I think when you see the web, whatever they're calling it now, the Competes Act or USICA, or, you know, I call it the Legalized Corruption Act of Schumer, because he's going to subsidize domestic semiconductors, right? Is you are going to see retaliatory responses from Beijing, the anti-foreign sanctions law, the blocking law, et cetera, right? This is where this is going to be headed. It's a second half story, but the course has been set.
Let's see, where do we want to wrap this up with? I think that we need to continue watching the China implications, continue to utilize the lessons out of Russia, Ukraine to better understand the full world stage, a refresher course in the rules-based order, not only the one you've given us the last hour, but really the one Putin has given us the last 2 months. Is the peace dividend gone? Was there a peace dividend? That's another tricky thing. People said, I've been asked this on CNBC and Fox a few times, you know, does this have implications to the market multiple or to bond yields or some element of market pricing, because there's been a peace dividend since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the ending of the Cold War? And I have a hard time pricing that, and I therefore would have a hard time unpricing it. But before I ask if the piece dividend, or however it's priced, is gone, I guess I have to ask you if it ever existed, because it doesn't feel to me like the last 32 years has been that peaceful, and it really didn't feel that way in Lower Manhattan on September 11th, 2001.
So look, I don't believe in the peace dividend. In fact, that was just an opportunity to squander U.S. national security on profligate social programs, I'll put it that way, right? The real quote-unquote peace dividend was the Cold War itself, right? From 1945 till 1989. And I think that is where we are going again. So to kind of wrap it up, let's talk about just a couple market implications of all this, because it actually does matter a great deal for the markets. This whole idea about re-regionalization and the world being split into competing blocks. The prior paradigm was the secular stagnation paradigm, which you know, which we've talked about at length. And that idea was predicated on two things. Number one, that you operate in a non-conflict world. And that two, it was a dematerialized world, right? Because with, you know, tech throwing off so much capital with such little, you know, capex, right? Was that you were going to have an oversupply of capital, and that was going to create a environment of extremely low interest rates, et cetera, right? Clearly now that is not the case, because given the capex that we need to do, that specific capex requires higher capital intensity and higher capital investment, which, ceteris paribus, right, requires higher interest rates. Now, the other thing is on the demographic side, right, with the millennial generation now coming into their prime earning age, and the baby booms consuming savings, spending savings, right? There's a lower supply of capital as well, right? So that speaks to a rise in the level of interest rates, number one, right? But I think number two is that it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be back to 7-8% 10-year rates or anything nonsense like that, right? It's that I think the bigger implication is that rather than so much capital flowing to the dematerialized world of technology and all the Eric Schmidt list, right, is that actually you're going to have more capital flowing to natural resources, energy, real assets, right? Things upstream that Eric Schmidt presupposes that he's always going to be able to attain, given his focus on quantum and AI and biotechnology and cyber, et cetera, robotics, all those things. That presupposes secure access to raw materials, to energy, to power, to food, right? This is, let's call it the value play, right? That's been totally ignored for the last surely 30 years, and that only now is starting to, markets are starting to price it, and that price signal is going to maintain, right? It's going to stay there because that's the capex that you need. And that is a policy mandate, and ultimately it's a mandate by the populations, because they require security, right? So this is the kind of, this is the story where we're at. And these are the market implications, that you need to invest in real things, real operational solutions that provide real IP at kind of, you know, at the wellhead, if you will, right?
And it's been true in my mind for some time that real things, real cash flows, real materials, real assets are more investable, particularly at the late innings of a big bull market, and particularly a valuation expansion. Multiple expansion increases the need for being invested in something real and tangible, whether that be free cash flow or things that can fall on your foot and hurt you.
Well, look, those things that fall on your foot and can hurt you produce free cash flows.
As well, that's sort of the idea of the creation mandate, isn't it?
That's right.
Generating cash flows and profit growth out of the raw material of creation. This has always been my understanding of free enterprise.
That's right. So look, I'll leave you with this, because I want to read this to you because it's so important. and it speaks to what's at stake. And I think it brings it back to the beginning of the conversation. There was an op-ed that I can send everyone that was going to be published in Russian media after the successful special military operation in Ukraine, right? And it said that we had ushered in a new world order, right? This invasion of Ukraine. And here was the final paragraph. And it articulates what the Russian view is, and I think what the block by force believes. It says, quote, because the construction of a new world order is accelerating, the multipolar world has finally become a reality. And the rest of the world sees and understands perfectly well that this is a conflict between Russia and the West. And it is a response to the geopolitical expansion of the United States and the Atlanticists. And it is a return of Russia to its historical space and place in the world. China and India, Latin America, Africa, the Islamic world, and Southeast Asia. None of these countries believe that the West is leading the world order, much less establishing the rules of the game. So Russia has not just challenged the West, it has shown that the era of Western global domination can be finally considered completely, fully over. The new world will be built by civilizations and centers by force, not on the West terms and not according to its rules.
Yeah.
That's where we're at. Yeah. All the marbles, David. All the marbles.
Renee, I could go on forever. We both have to cut out. We won't necessarily let you go another year without coming back and talking to us. You've given us a lot to think about, and I am deeply appreciative of all your work and for coming today on the Capitol Record.